Whoa.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Angie Coro, host of Live from the Left Coast, and I will moderate tonight's program. It is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Will Durst, radio commentator, author of The All-American Sport of Bipartisan Bashing, Common Sense Rantings from a Raging Moderate, and acclaimed political satirist. You might think of Will Durst as left-wing, slightly conservative, or smack in the middle. It depends on your filter. That is because he transcends party lines. I know because he says so on his own website. He has actually performed at events honoring both Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. According to the New York Times, he is quite possibly the best political satirist working in the country today. He has regular commentaries on Audible.com, Air America, CNN, NPR, all while performing hundreds of comedy shows every year. And that has led to 7 consecutive nominations for the American Comedy Awards Stand-Up of the Year. He's a 5-time Emmy nominee. In fact, he's been on TV in 14 different countries. He has 2 never-ending quests in his life: to find the perfect cheeseburger and to make people laugh out loud on purpose against their will. Please welcome Will Durst.
Thank you, Angie. That was great. And I've been nominated for Stand Up of the Year 7 years in a row and 5 Emmy nominations, and I've never won anything. Not even a toaster. So
I think the toaster is given out for a different honor. That's a different program on Ellen, I think.
Yeah, that's when you give money to the bank. Remember those days? They'd give you a toaster, and now my interest rates is 29.9%. It's my fault that they messed up so bad. Sorry.
If we set aside your quest for the perfect cheeseburger and talk instead about your quest to make people laugh.
Out loud on purpose against their will.
Well, looking on your website to get ready for tonight, I saw all the different changing faces of Will Durst comedian over the decades. Did you start as a political comedian, or did you start as a, you know, take my wife, please, and kind of segue into politics?
Both. You have to learn the language of stand-up in order to, I mean, everybody did. Lenny Bruce had to, Mort Saul had to. You have to learn how to make people laugh. Some people have an innate ability. Not me. I'm a Midwestern plotter. I had to figure it out. Death after death. Because when you die on stage, it is a memorable thing. It's not like when you do well on stage. When you do well on stage, you can't remember a thing. It's all a blur. You know, it's the way it should have been, you know. But when you die, everything is highlighted, italicized, in bold parentheses. It's time slows down for you to learn your lesson. So, but I was also forged in the crucible of the Vietnam War. When I graduated from high school, it was right in the middle of the war. And then I started going to college, and I started doing stand-up comedy when I was 19, and it was a class that I took at the university, Herb Felsenfeld, who actually moved to San Francisco. And he was one of these theater teachers that actually got involved with the students. And so he set up this thing, performance art, just do something, you know, to get us started. And I always wanted to be a stand-up comic. So I was writing a humor column for the university newspaper at the time. So I took all the funny bits from my humor column, and then I picked up some jokes, and I came to class, and I had a 7-minute bit. And I rehearsed it and memorized it, and I came to class, and this is in Milwaukee, and I had bought a case of beer with me, cold beer, and that's when you could smoke in classrooms, and I got those stamped tin ashtrays that they handed out in the student union. So I brought them in and closed all the most of the curtains, and I created like a stand-up comedy club kind of feel. And I actually made money because I made a profit on the beer. So my first gig I ever had, I made a profit on. And then I had my routine and went to the showcases that we had in Milwaukee. The one showcase, $1 to get in every Monday. And the people, the students from across the street, the Milwaukee School of Engineering, were we had to turn off the foosball machines and the pinball machines, and they were ticked off. So they would sit there and watch every Monday night. And if they could figure out what your punchline would be, they would yell it out. So I had to figure out this way to get to the punch, because you can't write that many jokes. But everything was political back then. I mean, social studies, of course, was political. But teachers found a way to make English political, make math political. The Viet Cong have 43 prisoners of war and 37 escape. How many are left? You know. So everything was political back then. And my dad read 5 newspapers a day. I just grew up thinking everybody did. So that's. And I also couldn't do relationship material because I didn't have any. So I was kind of stuck with political stuff.
We're actually going to explore that further later, so you have something to look forward to. But speaking of doing politics and comedy, I mean, isn't there an inherent risk that someone in the audience will be offended as opposed to just cracking funny jokes, everybody's kind of with you?
Yeah.
Would you care to expound on that, Mr. Durst?
Yeah, that's a problem you do run into, which is why I can't do cruises. And I always wanted to do one cruise. I always wanted to, because if you guys have been on a cruise, you know, there's always a comedian, and, you know, he's usually a bad comic, but he is there not to offend anybody. And I've had friends who are comics, because we all know each other. We hear horror stories about being on the road. I have a friend who said something, and he angered one of the patrons, and they flew a helicopter into the boat, and they picked him up, and they flew him out. Yeah. So he didn't have to do his second gig. So, that's one thing I always wanted to do. But it's also one of the reasons that I kind of emigrated here. Because when I left Milwaukee in 1980, well, November of 79, when I left, so wow, 30 years here. I just realized that. Yeah. When I left, there were 3 cities in the country where you could earn your living at stand-up comedy. And they were Chicago, Boston, and San Francisco. Not New York or L.A., because everybody's willing to do it for free, for exposure. But in the Midwest, we were taught, you can die from exposure. So I knew that I had to get my chops down first. And also, Chicago and Boston both had winter. So... And then I ended up in one of the best-read, most intelligent cities in America. And it allowed me, you know, to further my studies in political comedy. And also, 1980 was when Ronald Reagan was elected. And so it was the golden age of political comedy. Never again reached until 20 years later, when George W. Bush followed in those large footsteps. And I miss him today. I really do.
Well, you and I actually talked about that a couple times. We've met on the air a few times, and I was asking you toward the close of the George W. Bush era, if we can call it over, what was going to happen to comedians? Because it was so ripe with possibility every time he opened his mouth. And Obama doesn't give you that.
I actually had a whole routine, about a 7-minute routine, based on just his quotes. And I would just read his quotes. You know, one of them was, I think we can all agree, the past is over. When in Rome, do as the Romanians do. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Don't shake your head. Yes, he did. So now, you know, I mean, that's one of the big changes. It's nice having a president who, when he speaks with a foreign leader at a joint press conference at the White House, the other guy isn't more eloquent in English as a second language. That's one of the major changes.
It's interesting to watch the way people used to react to comedy where George Bush was the target and comedy where Sarah Palin is the target. It seems to incite a lot more anger.
Yes, and part of it has to do with time. There was a time where George Bush, you could not touch him. And we all know what that time was. It was September 12th, 2001. We were not allowed to say anything about George W. Bush. And that lasted until he choked on a pretzel. And then he was fair game again. You remember when that happened? He choked on a pretzel and fell off the couch and scraped his face. I guess the couch was made out of cheese graters or something. But then he was fair game again because he was a doofus. But still, San Francisco was, again, you know, surfing on that white foam of the crest of the tsunami of anti-Bush. And it took until Katrina to keep the water metaphor going. It took until the rest of the country fell into line. And then even in the South, you could do Bush jokes. So it took until 1995, you know, Katrina. And everybody went, yeah, you know, you're right. And then what happened was a lot of people said, oh, you know, with the Bush stuff, you know, we've heard it. You know, time to move on. He's low-hanging fruit. Yeah, so what? Yeah. You guys denied it for so many years. No, I'm going to shove it in your face. And I have found Sarah Palin. I did a gig back in Milwaukee this weekend, and I did three gigs, one in a conservative part, northern suburbs of Milwaukee, and one in south side of Milwaukee, which is real blue collar, and then one that nobody came to, so we will ignore that one. But the first one in Ozaukee County, I tried doing Sarah Palin material. They laughed at some of the Bush stuff. They laughed at the Obama stuff. And I tried doing Sarah Palin stuff. And the audience had this collective gasp. It was kind of... And all of them, I was almost pulled forward on stage. So what I did was I skipped like a stone, skipped across the lake. My job is not to proselytize. My job is not to... You know, my job is to make people laugh. So I moved on. You know, they didn't want to hear it, and it was fine with me. They will.
That reminds me of when you do a newscast, they always say you must bring more copy than you need because who knows, a reporter's not there when you go to them or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that what happens on stage where you go to Sarah Palin, it doesn't work, and you say, well, from my back pocket?
Yeah, you just skip over. I have this one joke that I do, and I love this joke. And the problem is I don't set it up. And the setup is during the Bush administration, a strategist for the GOP named Grover Norquist said, we're going to shrink the government to where we can drown them in my bathtub. So knowing that, I do a joke saying by 2012, the Republican Party may have shrunk to where you can drown them in Grover Norquist's bathtub. Exactly. That's I did that joke in D.C. I figured they would get it. No, nothing. So it's, yeah, you can't do it. Because I have friends who are political comics, and they're not just political. They're geniuses. They're poli-sci majors, and they get angry at the audience if they don't know something that appeared for the first time below the fold on page 18 of the New York Times. And I'm usually kind of more middle of the road. If it hasn't hit the cover of Newsweek magazine, I really can't talk about it. I can't, because I can't expect the audience. They have jobs and hobbies and families and stuff. I'm supposed to be the one that's reading and figure this stuff. I read so you don't have to. And my job is as translator, you know, to take, this is what they said, this is what they mean, you know.
You know, hidden there in that answer is one of your trademarks, that riff where it's adjective upon adjective or descriptor upon descriptor on the bottom of the page, September 17th, blah, 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 blah. You do that, obviously, you know, improv, you can do that here. But when you're doing your radio commentaries, how long does it take you to shape those? Because I have heard those lists go on for lines with perfect pacing and you know, a growing humor throughout. How long does that take you?
It's getting an image in your mind and then trying to find the words that fit around it. It's my favorite thing. You know, it really is. I write a, I do a bunch of stuff because I can't earn a living as a stand-up. So I patched together a comedy quilt. I do, the commentary she's referring to is I do a commentary every week, and then I send it out to different radio stations. And Angie's show, on 960, Green 960, from 4 to 6 every afternoon, is one of the shows that takes it. So it's a minute and a half commentary.
6 to 8 p.m.
Oh, 6 to 8. Sorry.
Thank you.
I had the 6 right. And then I write a column that's syndicated, but it's not syndicated, excuse me, with one of the big syndicators. There's like 7 big syndicators. It's one of the little syndicators. So I never know who's picking up my newspaper column until I get this angry email from Osceola, Florida, or Escanaba, Michigan. You know? So that's the only way. And then I do benefits, and what else do I do? Voiceovers. I'll do anything. You know, I'll sell out. I'm cheap, too, just so you know. But just trying to make a living. And the commentary and the written column is, I think, that's my favorite. And that's what the book is. The book is a collection of all those columns. Yeah. So, yeah.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we are talking with political satirist and author Will Durst. I'm Angie Coiro.
Author.
Radio. You did the Will and Willie show live in San Francisco from a hotel restaurant every morning. And you're still doing radio commentaries, and radio is a business that is awash in change. What's your experience with it?
Awash in change.
I'm continuing the water metaphor.
How delightful that sounds. Rather than the actual picture, which is doom and gloom, and the Mayans were right. if Sarah Palin gets the nomination. It's funny because in college I studied with theater and film. I studied journalism and broadcasting, and both of those occupations are kind of like you can see the darkness at the end of the tunnel. And fortunately, I had comedy to fall back on. But I did a morning radio show with Willie Brown, which was one of the best things I've ever done in my life. We did it for a year at the same station that Ms. Coiro is at right now. And it was so much fun. But the 4:30 a.m. wake-up call kicked my butt. Because I'm a comedian. Hello? Nighttime clubs, 2 shows. I have gone to bed after my wake-up call for this show more often than not. My wake-up call was 4 in the morning, and I was used to going to bed at 4 in the morning. So it was very confusing for my body. And I swear, we did it for a year, and it took 3 months before my body clock actually got back to normal. I was sleep-deprived. That was the worst part. The best part was when you had something to say. And Willie Brown, whether you love him or hate him, and there is no in-between, but he is the smoothest politician on the face of the planet. He's the only guy I know who can enter a revolving door behind you and come out first. Honest to God. He is smooth. And so he's a funny politician. I'm a political comic. We just had a great time, 3 hours a day. And a lot of people listened to it. And when they fired us, 2 months later, Willie ran into one of the guys from Clear Channel, and he said it was the biggest mistake we made. But, you know, after the fact, they can say whatever they want. You know, you know, it's like when you break up with a girlfriend. You know, I'm so sorry. You want to get back? No, no.
Did you have to pull any punches because it was Willie Brown sitting there?
I adjusted my timing to his timing, you know.
But not content?
No. No, I don't think so. No. You know, we butted heads a couple of times on the show. So, no, I don't have the governor to really self-edit well. I can do in-deck editing when it comes to a show, and I have that backlog. But when it's spontaneous, I'm not smart enough to do that. Yeah.
Let's talk about your private life.
I had no idea that she was that old. Honest to God. No. That was actually thrown out of court for lack of evidence.
You met and married another comedian.
A very funny comedian. And it's one of those meet cute kind of, you know, Sleepless in Seattle stories. I'm a comic. I'm a stand-up comic, and she's an improviser. My wife, Debbie Durst, much funnier than I am. Debi, she is. She's exceedingly funny. She has been called by Robin Williams the funniest person in California, And it's true. Because when Robin does an improv with somebody, he's so used to delivering a line and then walking backstage with his back to the audience, which is the ultimate power signal from a performer. And I've only seen two people come back to him so fast that he actually stutter-stepped and had to deal with it. And one was Rick Overton, and one was my wife, Debbie Durst. And she was on the show Whose Line Is It Anyway? The British version. And, yeah, she's very funny. But she refuses to work with cretinous toads, which in show business kind of puts you out. So I'm telling you more than you need to know. After the Third World War, there will be two forms of life left, cockroaches and club owners. but she still does improv, and we met at a comedy club. I used to do a bit called Death Insurance, where I would smoke an entire pack of cigarettes at a time. And it went, you love your family, don't you? Sure you do. That's why you buy insurance. And I'm talking about home insurance, health insurance, car insurance, and life insurance, because you want to make sure they're taken care of after you've gone. But what happens if you outlive your family? You'd feel really bad, wouldn't you? That's why I smoke these, and I'd pull out a cigarette and light a cigarette. And sometimes when they're feeling down, I'll smoke an entire pack at a time. And I had this box of Marlboros rigged up, so I would just pull off the top, stick the entire thing in my mouth. And I always had Zippo lighters, so I would just light an entire pack of cigarettes. And then proceed to fall into a coughing fit. and then put the lighted pack of cigarettes in an ashtray that had a little piece of magician's flash paper in it. So it would go, and they're dangerous too. Remember, smoke cigarettes, not for your health, for your family. Needless to say, it had to be my final bit of my act because I couldn't breathe. So I would walk into the audience with this pack of smoldering saliva-covered butts and offer them to the audience, and they'd recoil, you know. Ah! And she actually reached over and grabbed one, and I went, I love her. Because her improv group, she used to work at the Spaghetti Factory in San Francisco, and they would work every weekend. They were called Spaghetti Jam, and Robin was part of them, Betty Thomas, who went on to direct, and Robin Urich, and a bunch of people were all playing. You know, Michael Bossier, which is her current partner, Deb and Mike, when they go up, and they still perform. And they were closing down the Spaghetti Factory, which was exactly what it says, you know, a lot of red sauce. But on weekends, they would perform in the space. Well, they were closing it down, so they were on the tour, and they were hosting the Punchline. And we met, and then I pushed her down on Ocean Beach and ruined her good pair of white pants. And yeah, that's, you don't need to know that.
No, go ahead.
And we've been married now for 28 years. Six of the happiest years of my life. No 2 weeks contiguous. And I don't regret one day. And that one day was a Thursday in May of 84 because she was sick and she had slept the entire day.
You still work with her on your year-end things. Your year-end.
She produces that show.
She produces that.
Yeah, every year we do the big fat year-end kiss-off comedy show. And this will be the 17th year. We'll be at the Dean Lesher here in Walnut Creek. Anybody ever seen that show? Three people in the back.
And
Angie,
me.
Thank you. But we hit six different cities. Seven comedians, six nights, and we end in Mill Valley on New Year's Eve. So we start out the day after Christmas, and we look back on the year, and it's so much fun, you know, because it's just about that year, the stuff that happened. And this year, you know, we expected, oh, God, we're going to have to stretch and dig. No! Everything, town hall, healthcare, riots, people holding up signs saying, stop socializing America and hands off my Medicare. At least use two different signs. Pirates, there were pirates this year. And real pirates, you know, with guns and boats and rum and arg. So there was so much that happened. And, you know, and the people who are just never going to get used to the fact that the country is now being run by a black guy living in public housing. You know, Just never going to get, and you know, they kept their kids out of school so they weren't subjected to a subversive message to stay in school. So yeah, there's plenty of grist.
Well, that's a great time to ask how you synthesize all that. The year's going by and strange and funny things are happening, and you toss them in a hat and pull them all out later and put together a year-end show, or how does this work?
Well, our main writer is Michael Bossier. Because we do stand-up. There's seven comics. Devin Mike is an act, so it's six acts. So we do stand-up, and then we do a skit, and then stand-up, and then a skit. And then at the end, we all think. No. God, no, you don't want that. So we have a guy who helps write all the skits and sketches. And we'll, I think we're going to do answering machine messages this year as like the blackout pieces. You know, like, oh, welcome to the Dick Cheney drum circle retreat. You know, stuff like that. You know, because what's he doing now? Remember at the inaugural, he looked like Dr. Strangelove? You know, or Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life? And, yeah, so there's always something.
I'm going to start integrating some of the questions from the audience.
Oh, cool.
And I love the way this one is phrased. What can you do with first ladies?
Geez, if this weren't going out on NPR, I'd have a great line. Nothing. You really have to stay away from them, I think. It's not fair to bring the family in unless they start getting involved in policy, like Nancy Reagan would just say no, how clueless that was. And but Laura, you know, was pretty much out of it. Hillary, of course, was in it because she wanted, you know, her nose was deeply into it. So, but not much. The only joke I have that even tangentially includes Michelle is when she introduced him at a rally. And as she came off stage and he came on, they did a little fist bump, you know. And everybody knows what the fist bump is. It's filtered down to the Caucasian community. I mean, even you guys have an idea, right? And it wasn't, you know, like a sports fist bump. It was like a kink. You know, it was like, it was kink. It was a Hello Kitty fist bump, you know, kink. And Fox News called it terrorist fist jab. And then remember the New Yorker cover? Had them doing it, and she was in the dashiki with the AK-47, and the picture of Bin Laden over the fireplace. And, yeah, the New Yorker. That's what happens when liberals try to help.
Which leads me right to my next question. Someone who says you really are a lefty, after all.
You know what? It's geographic. A lot of it's geographic. Because when I'm at home in Milwaukee, I'm a commie pinko yellow rat. You know, but in San Francisco, I'm a Nazi. They're quite mad. They are. I mean, come on. That city, they're more interested in crafting the proper foreign policy than fixing the roads. Oh, it'd drive you nuts. I mean, sometimes the city can be. I love it for the tolerance. Because we don't care if you're a Lithuanian, red-bearded, vegan dwarf into golden showers. Come on down. The water is fine. It's tepid. You'll love it. You know, I mean, the only thing we refuse to tolerate in San Francisco is intolerance. We hate the judgmental. Kill them. So sometimes it can be, I mean, sometimes, come on, you just want a cheeseburger. You don't need it covered in a mango chutney aioli. You know? It's a lovely roasted sun-dried tomato basil reduction. In the Midwest, you know what we call it? Ketchup. Yeah. It is geographic. I'm convinced.
Is Governor Schwarzenegger grist for your comic mill?
Oh, God, I'm going to miss him. And I liked him because he ticked off Republicans and Democrats. And he couldn't run for president. Yeah. But I'm not going to miss his using his lines from his movies as part of governance. Because he only had like 40 cumulative lines, so he was starting to repeat himself. You know, I'll be back. Yeah, that was cute the first 8,000 times. He actually said during the special election, you can't handle the truth. It's not even your movie. That's Nicholson. Come on now. What's next? I don't know nothing about birth and no babies. These are not the droids you're looking for. You had me at hello.
He's a really good, he's a good example that we can use to say, what's off limits with a political target? Schwarzenegger, you have his accent, you have his family, you have his history, you've got his movie work. As a matter of taste and as a matter of what's genuinely funny, you look at someone like that and say, what's off limits? What can I use as comic fodder?
You know what I do? Because of the whole journalism background, I see myself as kind of a living editorial cartoon or a stand-up journalist, you know. So my idea is that old credo of journalism, to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, that's my, because you don't pick on people less fortunate than yourself. That's my only, that's out of bounds, you know. That's, and I won't pick on Sasha or Malia. And I did the Bush twins, but only when they were, you know, ducking the Secret Service to get served in bars. You know, I figured that was open game. Otherwise, you know, if the developmentally disabled, I don't understand using that as a punchline. I don't think that's right. I think you pick on Jerry Brown, pick on Gavin Newsom, which is very easy.
As you travel across the country, and knowing, of course, that this audio is going to go across the country and follow you. What are your favorite parts of the country to perform in and your least favorites?
You know what I need is people who read or know someone who does. So it's not that restrictive. I really like Seattle, Portland, San Francisco. I love the left coast. I do. And the upper right-hand corner of the United States is good, and Chicago. And, you know, I have my problems in the south, so we've kind of come to an agreement. If you draw an invisible line between St. Louis and Atlanta, I don't work south of there, and they don't hire me. So it's a beneficial agreement. It's not that, and people always say this, that the south is less intense. No, that's not true. It's subtropical, so they move a little different, and they don't like their humor sarcastic or ironic. They want it upfront and good-natured. No hidden agendas, if you please. You know, but that's because, and I'm convinced that even in the reddest of states, that where they're going to hire me is going to be a little blue pocket anyhow. And the red states and the blue states, and that's such a convenient, and I think facetious? No, not fallacious. Fallacious. Yeah, it's a fallacious argument. It doesn't. You know, you can't say that Pierre, South Dakota, is any less intelligent than Prairie Sheen, Wisconsin. You know, it just depends on if they got the New York. If they're selling the New York Times at the gas station, I'm in. How about that? That's a lot quicker.
Can you give us a little taste of one of the routines or one of the engagements that convinced you the South wasn't your kind of place to be booked anymore?
Well, I do this thing about religion, and I know that's going to, flip everybody out. And I preface it by saying I believe that there is a God, a higher force. It's not that hard to believe in a higher intelligence than man. I think the proof that there is intelligent life on other planets is the fact they've obviously chosen not to contact us. Stay away from the noisy blue planet. They urinate in their water supply. Swear to God. Yeah.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program.
Not the usual Commonwealth radio program, and I apologize for that.
That would be political satirist and author Will Durst, and I'm Angie Cuero. Current events, vaccinations. We have people who think they're a very bad idea. Think people who think that those who think that shouldn't be allowed to send their children to school, that's very touchy. Can you make comedy out of that?
The problem is I can see kind of both sides. You know, I can see by empirical evidence, people are telling them the internet says, and, they're not doctors. It's like people are afraid of the health care bill because we're afraid of our own doctors. Now you're talking about 1,900 pages of government fixes? And it's easy to understand why people are quivering like a bead of water dancing across a pancake grill. I mean, And it doesn't help when you have members of Congress saying that the plan has provisions to kill the elderly. Well, that's going to tend to freak people out. Like the elderly! Or the soon-to-be elderly. So I can understand why people are, you know, it's just about education. It's getting the word out, you know. I mean, it's easy to see why these people are so leery of public health care. They've obviously been grievously failed by the public education system. I love you guys. Been using that joke for 2 months. That's the best response I've got. See, that's what I'm saying. People who read, you know.
Now that you mention that, comedy used to be for people occasionally appearing on television, but a lot of live comedy, and you could use the same shtick frequently and not hit the same people. Now you're on the internet, you're on TV, you're on radio, you're everywhere.
My routine will change every 2 years, pretty much 85% in 2 years. But and something, a catalyst like the changing of a president, you know, that will force me to write, which I like. The hardest part is not writing the new stuff. The hardest part is kicking my babies out of the nest. The old jokes. I mean, you know, my William Howard Taft material just doesn't have the same bite anymore, you know. I have Reagan, Bush, Quayle, Clinton, you know. So that's the hard part is getting rid of the old stuff. Not writing the new stuff. But I'm still in high school. I don't know about you. But if it's due Monday morning, I don't start it till after the Sullivan Show, you know.
But does your stuff age faster? Or?
Anybody old enough? Yeah. Yeah. See, when I'm in a club, I'll say 60 minutes, you know. But yeah. See, I'm not as dumb as I look. Thank you.
But you don't find that your content ages faster? There are more venues people could have heard it through?
Yeah, I guess. But listening to it in a radio commentary, reading it in a syndicated column, and then seeing it on stage, three totally different voices. The stage voice, for me, and I could probably get away with being wry, which, you know, and... just throwing out a quip here, but I'm so steeped in the timing of the Modesto, the Central Valley one-nighter, that if the audience isn't laughing, I'm talking. So it's a whole different rhythm, and I can have a joke in the paper, and you can start out setting up with a premise at the beginning of the column, and then slowly weave through and having a couple of little word puzzles in there for them to get, and then sell it or pay it off at the end. Comedy, they got the attention span of high speed lint, so you better get to the joke, and so it's three different ways to look at the same joke, even if they are you know exposed to it, which is highly doubtful. Even my wife, well, she can't. No.
Do you guys test material on each other?
We have this long-standing tradition because she still performs. She's with a group now called the Dinosaurs of Improv because they're all ancient. That's the Jurassic era. But I'll come home, find a quarter of my pillow, which means that she has used one of my lines in her act, in her little routine, and versa vice. If she comes up with something, they'll put a quarter in her pillow, you know. So that's, yeah. So we support each other, and we cannibalize each other, too. That's an odd relationship.
You mentioned the element of time earlier, and you hear that the comedy equals tragedy plus time, mm-hmm. but tragedy plus time also makes things irrelevant. You know, things age so quickly. How do you ride that line?
Oh man, I'm struggling all the time, trying to bring stuff back or make it current. Or you know, there's a lot of stuff that happened this year that I had joked, and I can't think of it right now if I looked at my notes. But jokes at the beginning of the inaugural. I mean, there was so much that happened at the inaugural, and it was funny for a week. You know, and like they were criticizing Obama, and they criticized Obama for not being poetic enough, and he might have disrespected Bush, and well, he didn't do a lot of things. He didn't walk on the reflecting pool. He failed to part the Potomac. How come he didn't use his ears as wind baffles to protect us from the briskness? Say it was really, really cold. So if you say, but yeah. That's just one of the, you know, the exigencies of the gig, the occupational hazards, you know. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it'll last forever, you know, like, and I'm struggling with this one, how long I can use this one, that Bill Clinton flew over to North Korea on an empty plane and came home with two hot Asian journalist chicks. He's still good. Yeah, see, and the joke is from the previous line, and just saying he's still good allows you to laugh. That's interesting. Yeah. What do you want to bet he got debriefed on the plane? Yeah, everybody's oohing, but you're still laughing at the same time. Yeah.
Are you going to give quarters out to the... They're like a test audience. We should give quarters to each
other. No, that's a routine. You know, it's just I don't know if it's still current enough, but it happened this year. So I can always... That's why... that's why having to look back, you know, is an excuse to bring back material that might be kind of lame by now. But the pirates are going to last. You know, Hillary Clinton talking tough to the pirates. Them's that dies is the lucky ones, you know.
But there's also, I mean, in addition to currency, in addition to something being in people's minds, there's also how sensitive it still is. I'm thinking of Katrina. I mean,
it was impossible to talk about. There's a curious effect about the economy. That a year ago, I was talking about the economy. Oh, man, my 401k is now a single-digit K. It might just be K. You know, people laughing. No, not so funny. Yeah. My wife and I are trying to downsize. We went from a $700,000 house to a $350,000 house. We didn't even have to move. And I'm getting a lot of people in the audience now laughing, just going. So yeah, it's waves, it's sine waves that you have to be able to predict, and the audience, everybody calls it a monologue, but it's not a monologue. It's a dialogue, and the audience will tell you when you're conversing with them and when you're conversing at them, and their laughter is their end of the dialogue. So every audience is like a fingerprint too. Every audience is different. I forget who it was. I just reviewed Carlin's book for the Chronicle, and at the end I had this great line: Lenny Bruce died for our sins, but George Carlin lived for him. Yeah, I love it. And there was a line where he was talking about people, how he likes people. He just hates them when they get into groups of two or more.
Very Carlin.
Yeah, very true.
I love this question from an audience member. Would your comic routine be significantly different if McCain had taken office?
You know, every switch is like turning the Titanic. In order to take the 45 minutes that I built up on George Bush and the ilk, then the lush tropical rainforest that were the two terms of George Bush. I'm serious, for 8 wonderful years, he was like a father to me. But, and then to switch and to go to McCain would have had the same kind of chunky, you know, feeling it out, metal detector kind of nature that Obama did. Only with Obama, it's harder because you have the racial thing involved, and a lot of liberals won't laugh. I mean, as soon as I bring up the fact that he's half black, you can hear everybody, you know, just shut down out there, you know. And isn't that just like America? Oh yeah, we can elect an African, but how about we start out with a half black guy? You know, like a starter Negro, like a hybrid or baby steps. You know. We work our way up the Ving Rhames. You know. Of course, you know who plays Barack in the movie. That's right, Tom Hanks. So, but McCain, it would have been a different thing. But remember who his vice presidential candidate was? Yeah. And for those of us going cold turkey and George Bush, Sarah Palin's like a double dose of methadone. She's the gift that keeps on giving.
I have visions of you secretly voting for her.
Well, you know, your intro, you said I performed for two presidents. That's correct, but it's not even enough. I performed for three elected presidents, Bill Clinton, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Al Gore. That's why all this talk, you know, about, oh, the imposters who crashed the White House. They did it for one day. What about the imposters who crashed the White House for 8 years, you know? Liberals.
In the most recent election, we saw, one of our guests writes, a rejection of really wealthy candidates who bought their way into office. Do you think Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina, who plan on spending a lot, should be nervous?
Yes, but not necessarily for that reason, not for the Huffington reason. I mean, no matter how rich Huffington was, he couldn't get past the fact that he was a lousy candidate. And I think Carla Fiorina and Meg Whitman and this other guy, I can't remember his name, the initials are DD, but he's running in the state of California. And none of these people have voted. They happen to be rich people who can finance their own, but they didn't even bother voting. And I think that's going to come and bite them in the butt. You know, I think people want to know. You know, it's not an entry-level position. You know, we've seen it happen. It didn't work out that well. You know, we're going to look for somebody with a little bit of... But the anti-Washington and, you know, the know-nothings and the Glenn Becks and, you know, who try to break everything down to its... he apologized. You know, sometimes you have to apologize. Yeah. So I think that's going to be their problem, not the fact that they're little Richie Riches.
Since you brought it up, Glenn Beck.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they just yell. And I understand being the opposition party and the minority party, but, you know, you got to pick your battles. Even Mike Huckabee said that, you know, the Republican Party has to stop needlessly picking on Obama. And it turns out the creationist is the most evolved. Who'd have thunk? But Glenn Beck, I mean, he was so incensed at Barack winning the Nobel Peace Prize. It's a peace prize. I don't care who's handed it out. I don't care if it's Keebler-Elves, you know, dropping them out of a hollowed-out log or something. It's a peace. Well, he got it with only 12 days in office. He showed early promise. And you know he's going to pull a Kanye West and rush the award ceremonies, you know, yelling out that Dick Cheney deserved it more.
I know I keep coming back to the mechanics and the logistics of comedy, but I want to talk about what you just chose to make a punchline, and that was the creationist is the most involved. What were the machinations in the back of your head going, okay, we may have creationists here, we may have... What did you go through before that?
Well, it's just coming up with creationist as a shortcut for Huckabee. Because remember, because he's a Baptist minister, former governor of Arkansas. Last year was a bad year for former governors of Arkansas. He was also the guy who was one of the... Well, during the Republican debate in New Hampshire last year, in February of last year, of 08, when the Republicans responded to the Democratic call for change with nine rich old white guys wearing the same suit talking about change. During that, one of the debates were so unwieldy that Tom Brokaw actually, you know, had people raise their hands near the end of the hour, like socialists. You know, who believes taxes are bad, families are good, the future is yet to come? Raise your hand. I do. You know, and one of the questions he threw a high, hard, tight one. He said, "Who doesn't believe in evolution?" And for the Republican nominee wannabes, hands went up, including Huckabee. Now, fast forward to April, where he's the last guy running against McCain, and they said, "Why are you still in the race?" He said, "Because at this point, it's survival of the fittest." Right? So now this is this is where I'm, you know, and I felt bad because I've been telling that joke for a while. And then he actually says, you know, we got to stop needlessly complaining and pointing out Bush. But there is an entire industry. I mean, Obama, there's an entire industry. I mean, they were calling for his impeachment on January 21st. So it's, and I understand the nature. The problem is, we moderates, we don't have that provocative of a message. That's why the media, you know, loves the fight. They love the antipathy. They love the provocative nature. You know, for a moderate to say, well, we fervently believe that this issue deserves more study. You know, I mean, it's not that, you know, it's, You know, which is why you end up with Glenn Beck and you know, Sheryl Crow and Ann Coulter and Rachel Maddow and
Sheryl Crow,
as an activist, she wants everybody in America restricted to one square of toilet paper per bathroom visit. All right, lady, but you're doing my laundry, okay?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with political satirist and author Will Durst. I'm Angie Coiro, and putting two questions together here. California politics, constitutional convention, the run for governor, UC tuition increases, the budget crisis. How can we pick ourselves up? Who would be your pick for governor? And another audience member asks, would you run for governor? So do all of California, will you please?
Yes. Well, I don't know if the rest of the country is that excited, but, you know, we all have always been the petri dish of social change here in California. And I think we can pretty much plot, look at the grid and plot the demise, the beginning of the demise of Proposition 13. And as we all know, Proposition 13 was a good idea because the elderly were being forced out of their houses by the raise in property value. But corporations have figured out how to scam their little portion of Proposition 13. So we should just rescind Proposition 13 on the corporate level. It's not that difficult, but try getting a politician to figure this out, somebody who gets their contributions from corporations. So let me see, what are the odds of that happening? Not a match. The board goes back. So that's the problem. Losing Gavin Newsom in the race, because you remember he dropped out of the race for the Democratic nominee for the governor, and when he dropped out, he was kind of pouting, and he actually left San Francisco. Didn't tell anybody where he was going, and this is how bad he wanted out of town. He flew coach. But no matter what you think of what do you think of Gavin's policies, you got to admire his ability not to get involved in them. So, and Jerry Brown, health, obviously not an issue. He just got a clean bill of health from his paleontologist. So I think, and running for governor, no, I was tempted during the recall. But there were already so many comedians. Don Novello ran, and a bunch of people ran. There was another comedian. I think Gallagher ran. I ran for mayor of San Francisco in 1987. And I got 2% of the vote. I came in fourth out of 11. I spent $1,500. The three guys who beat me out, Roger Boaz, Art Agnos, and John Molinari, each spent $1 million apiece. And I spent $1,500. I get to, on the dollar per vote basis, I am mayor of San Francisco. But as we all know, it doesn't work that way. Yeah.
Did you do that as a comic effort? I did
in the beginning, and then I would go to these candidate forums, and I'd be doing my little jokes, and nobody cared. So then I had to rethink and retrench, and then I would actually, I came up with this great idea of making Alcatraz a casino, and all I wanted was the ferry concessions, you know. One of the big three, the guys who beat me out, actually took my idea and ran with it. Yeah. So I see myself as the position incubator.
Would you run for something smaller? Would you run for city councils? Anything like that? Do you have
maybe
that
for the benefits, but that's about it. For the insurance. I don't know about you. and get yours insurance. Of course, Medicare is not that far away. So like you never thought about that. Yeah. Uh-huh.
We have more audience members throwing names at you. Let's toss this one out to you. Rudy Giuliani.
Rudy Giuliani?
Yeah. What's his future, do you think?
Oh, I you know, it's funny because as New Yorkers, when they go to retire, they always go to Florida, and that's where his career ended. So he might just stay there. I never understood his campaign last year. He was apparently targeting that pro-gay rights, pro-gun control, pro-choice wing of the Republican Party. So you get those two guys, where do you go, you know?
Oh, good question about the family. We're seeing a lot of people associated with C Street and a strong religious right influence.
Yeah, I don't know if the... Do you guys know what the family is? It's this house on C Street up by the Capitol where the bad Republicans go. And I think both Vickers and Sanford went. Nevada Senator John Vickers and South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, the guy who, you know, went hiking on the Appalachian Trail. Yeah. And they both went there seeking solace and forgiveness. And I think the Republican Party gave it to them because they were just, you know, happy that they were caught with women.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember which of them was encouraged by the family at C Street. He had to go resign. He had to end his relationship with his mistress, and they drove him to the mailbox where he dropped in his resignation with the help of his family brethren. And then he ran around the corner and called her and said, "You're going to get this letter. Don't pay any attention to it."
Is that true?
It's true. That has Will Durst written all over it. I thought she would have grabbed that one.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not just a Republican thing. You get John Edwards, you know, doing the same thing, having an affair. And when he was caught in the affair, you know, because his wife, you know, was recovering from cancer. And he said, "Oh, no. When I had the affair, my wife was in remission." Yeah, he is such a lawyer.
I wanted to save this one toward the end here. The future of political comedy. Do you think there's still room for up-and-coming political satirists?
Yeah, it's rife. And there's reason for it. The new media, the blogosphere and all that seems to be killing journalism, but it's making people more aware, the 24-hour news channels and national newspapers, because you can go anywhere now and people will have the same, because comedy is about shared references, you know, which is why I have a hard problem when I go to Britain and I'm going to go off on a little China tour, China and Singapore and I think Tokyo, there's a gig in Tokyo. So it's like a week long, and I have to internationalize my act. Well, that's getting harder and harder. I used to do Edinburgh a month a year. I would go to the Fringe Festival. And it used to be easier, and now I'm becoming... So everybody knows what you're talking about now. And it's wonderful with the shared... And it's... Yeah, you have a tinier segment of the audience. It's not like... But the thing that I can do... That Bill Maher and Jon Stewart can't do is I can personalize it. Because you look at them, and you look at their shows at the end of the night, and you look at that writing staff. There's 13 different people in that staff. They're like the Walmarts of political comedy. I'm like a small boutique in Soho. I hand-stitch every joke. And there's no outsourcing either. So, yes, I think... And I think the kids are smarter, and they are using the new media. There's a autotone. There's these kids who are doing incredible YouTube parodies, just very, very funny. So, yeah, it is happening everywhere.
But with all of the venues, what does that do to the possibility of actually making a living being a political satirist?
Oh, that's impossible still. You can't. No, you can't do it. It's a pipe dream. No.
Have you seen the golden age of political satire? Do you think that's not going to be true for the next generations? In terms of becoming a professional.
I don't know. It's because when I started out, comedy was like rock and roll for people who wanted to sit down, you know, and hear the lyrics. And it was almost verbal jazz because you had a much more erudite, you know, slower paced audience that would listen to the words. I mean, Mort Saul, you know, those grand masters who were able to, you know, just take their time and the audience would be on the edge. And now, because of my timing is still kind of half and half between old school and new school, and now the kids are all new school, so I don't know if they, but yeah, you can find an audience. Janine Garofalo, who does wonderful political stuff, and she has a Margaret Cho, you know. So yeah, there will always be we always have politicians, you know. 535 of the best writers on the face of the planet.
What about the influence of Jon Stewart and Colbert, where people are now saying not only are they some of the best comedians around, but they literally look to them as news sources?
Well, they're as unbiased as Fox News is, you know, only from the other side. So it's easily digestible, and you actually get straight facts from them. And he will hit both sides. Stewart will, at least. You know, Stewart will hit both sides. But it's, people are always bemoaning, oh, you know, back in the 30s, everybody got their news from Walter Winchell. Everybody got their news from Jimmy Cannon. Everybody got their news from Walter Cronkite. It's always changing. It's always morphing. So it is what it is. And, you know, as long as we hold their feet to the fire to tell us the truth, that's all you get to worry about.
I want to follow this line of what's happening along the lines of comedians. You bill yourself as a moderate. There are people who would argue with that.
Oh, yeah.
That's how you
On both
yourself.
Sides.
Is that disappearing, what with the bifurcation we've seen, this split that we've seen in the American politics, because Stewart speaks to the left largely? You know, I don't know. Who speaks on the right comedian-wise? Dennis Miller?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's about it. The right always says, well, journalists and college university professors, you know, they're prejudiced because they're always liberal. Well, that's because they're educated. Hence the meaning of the word liberal, accepting of many viewpoints. Well, you got Glenn Beck and you got Keith Olbermann, and Keith Olbermann sometimes drives me nuts. You know, and say they, so you have those. The problem is the middle 60%, you have to, you know, it's kind of like they're not political parties anymore. They're teams, and you root for your team, win or lose, you know, right or wrong. You just root for them because it's gotten to be so combative. I will root for the San Francisco Giants. I don't care who's playing for them. You know, Charlie Manson could come in as long as he can not swing at that inside slider. You know, I root for Laundry. I'll admit it. If they're wearing my uniform, I'll root for them. Sorry. Hence my defense of Barry Bonds.
What does that do for you, though, as a comedian?
Not that he's Charlie Manson. I'm sorry. A lot of people. Are you saying? No, I'm sorry.
That's correct. I was just asking what that does to you as a moderate comedian. I mean, might you be, you know, looking at an era where we're not going to see a moderate comedian for something? You're pitching for this team or that team, not the middle?
I think the general audience knows that. I think it's mostly the voices that have to be strident, you know, the media voices. But the general audience, it happens, the fringes hijacking the movements. Happens on both sides. We saw it at the town hall riots. We always see it on the left at the anti-war protests. You know, it's an anti-war protest, and who's getting all the media attention? The black hooded sweatshirt anarchist and the sea turtle people. You know, what are you doing here? It's sea turtle people. It's an anti-war. The sea turtles are always at war. You know, I mean, so it always happens.
We have just about 90 seconds left. I'd love to get a little taste of your end-of-the-year extravaganza. Can we get a sneak peek?
Oh, well, the top 10 news stories of the end of the year. One is obviously cash for clunkers. Now, these are the comedic news stories. These are not legitimate news stories, because legitimate news stories, you know, blood and death and bleeding from the ears and destruction, not funny. No, I'm talking cash for clunkers, because the first time I heard about it, I thought it was about raising the per diem for the Senate. Then, of course, there's the swine flu, because that was scary. And I don't know if you remember this, but Joe Biden went on Good Morning America and said, during swine flu, not going to catch me on a subway. Shut up! No way, I'm flying. Shut the hell up! What is wrong with you? You're supposed to be helping. This is hindering. So those are definitely going to be two of the top stories of the year.
All right. Thank you so much, Wilders.
Hey, what a great job Angie Coiro did. Thank you so much.
I'm going to leave a quarter on your pillow for that. That's your kickback. Our thanks to Will Durst, political satirist and author of The All-American Sport of Bipartisan Bashing. We also thank our audience here. Thank you very much. And on the radio, I'm Angie Coiro. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.
I don't have any books.